Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. As I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35,000ths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Sebastian, please. Don't interrupt my act. Sebastian.
Well, Mr. Blowers, I didn't see the lights there. I forgot about them.
What in the world are you doing?
Why interrupt my act like this?
Well, look, Mr. Blowers, I mean, after all, if you're in a ballpark, they always sell peanuts and popcorns and things like that.
I know that, Sebastian, but not in front of them. I beg your pardon, friend.
Ladies and gentlemen, and also the children, will you excuse me for a minute, please?
Thank you. What do you want to do?
Look, Mr. Blowers.
What are you doing?
I love baseball.
Well, we all love baseball.
When we get to St. Louis, will you tell me the guys' names on the team so when I go to see them in that St. Louis ballpark, I'll be able to know those fellas?
Well, now, is it all right, folks? All right.
Excuse me, I want to find out the fellas' names.
As long as it's okay with the audience.
I'm crazy about baseball.
Will you stand still? Pick up your hat. Go pick up your hat.
Okay.
Now, look. Then you'll go and peddle your popcorn and don't interrupt the act anymore?
Yes, sir.
All right. But you know, strange may seem, they give ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
Funny names?
Nicknames, pet names.
Not as funny as my name, Sebastian Dinwiddie.
Oh, yes.
Funnier than that?
Oh, absolutely. Whee! Yes, now, on the St. Louis team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellas on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
Do you know the fellas' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean, the fellas' name on first base.
Who?
The fella playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who is on first?
Have you got a first baseman on first?
Certainly.
Then who's playing first?
Absolutely.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Why not? The man's entitled to it.
Who is?
Yes.
So who gets it?
Why shouldn't he? Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. After all, the man earns it.
Who does?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no, no. What is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy.
What's the guy's name on first base?
What's the guy's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
Stay off of first, will you?
Well, what do you want me to do?
Now, what's the guy's name on third base?
Well, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again.
Well, I can't change their names.
Will you please stay on third base, Mr. Broadhurst?
Please, now, what is it you want to know?
What is the fella's name on third base?
What is the fella's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
Woo! You got an outfield?
Oh, sure.
St. Louis has got a good outfield?
Absolutely.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I don't know. I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Then tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
Stay out of the infield.
Don't mention any names out here.
I want to know what's the fella's name in left field.
What is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base.
Take it easy, man.
And the left fielder's name?
Why?
Because.
Oh, he's center field. Will you pick up your hat, please? Pick up your hat and stop this. Oh, look, please.
Mr. Broadhurst.
Yes.
Wait a minute. You got a pitcher on a team?
Wouldn't this be a fine team without a pitcher?
I don't know. Tell me the pitcher's name.
Tomorrow.
You don't want to tell me today?
I'm telling you, man.
Then go ahead.
Tomorrow.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you're going to tell me who's pitching?
Now, listen. Who is not pitching? Who is on?
I'll break your arm. You say who's on first?
Why come up here and ask?
I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base. You got a catcher?
Yes.
The catcher's name.
Today.
Today. And tomorrow's pitching.
Now you've got it.
That's all. St. Louis has got a couple of days on the team.
Well, I can't help that. All right. What do you want me to do?
Got a catcher?
Yes.
I'm a good catcher too, you know.
I know that.
I would like to play for the St. Louis team.
Well, I might arrange that.
I would like to catch. Now, I'm being a good catcher. Tomorrow's pitching on the team, and I'm catching.
Yes.
Tomorrow throws the ball, and the guy up bunts the ball.
Yes.
Now, when he bunts the ball, me being a good catcher, I want to throw the guy out at first base, so I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now, that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Well, that's all you have to do.
Is to throw it to first base.
Yes.
Now, who's got it?
Naturally.
Who has it?
Naturally.
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 Okay.
Now, you've got it.
I pick up the ball and I throw it to naturally.
I know, you don't. You throw the ball to first base.
Then who gets it?
Naturally.
Okay.
All right.
I throw the ball to naturally.
You don't. You throw it to who?
Naturally.
Well, that's it. Say it that way.
That's what I said.
You did not.
I said I throw the ball to naturally.
You don't. You throw it to who?
Naturally.
Yes.
So I throw the ball to first base and naturally get it.
No. You throw the ball to first base.
Then who gets it?
Naturally.
That's what I'm saying.
You're not saying that.
Excuse me, folks.
All right. I'm sorry, friend.
I throw the ball to naturally.
You throw it to who?
Naturally.
Actually, well, say it that way.
That's what I'm saying.
Don't get excited. Now, don't get excited.
I throw the ball to first base.
Then who gets it?
He better get it.
All right. Now, don't get excited. Take it easy.
Now, I throw the ball to first base. Whoever it is drops the ball so the guy runs a second.
Mm-hmm.
Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it? I don't know. I don't know. Throws it back to tomorrow. A triple play.
Yeah, it could be.
Another guy gets up and it's a long fly ball to because. Why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't care.
What was that?
I said, I don't care.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
Today's It's My House is titled The Milwaukee, let me pronounce this right, or attempt to, the Metawalkin brand. Yesterday, we had a friend of mine call in and she has a relative that's a part of the Minnewaukan tribe in Minnesota. And this is Identity Week, so today is Friday. We're doing our conclusion for this series on identity for this week. We'll pick it up later. But the Minnewaukan, like I said, is a Native American tribe or sub-tribe of the Sioux Nation. So we're going to go into the Minnewaukan ID or identity, or as we titled this podcast, the Minnewaukan brand, 619-768-2945. It's the holiday season, so we'll play this little holiday cheer song and get back into the Minnewaukan brand.
You know, there's that cheer. Comet and Cupid and Zander and Blitzen. Oh, but do you recall the most famous name?
And today's podcast on identity, we're going to focus in on the Minnewaukan tribe, which is a sub-tribe of the Sioux Nation in Minnesota. And let's go to the first audio before we give you some details on the Minnewaukan tribe.
I'm just thinking about all Native people and the chronic health conditions that we deal with at such disproportionate levels, you know, compared to other populations. And many of those chronic conditions, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity, arthritis even, can be addressed with clean, healthy food. If people have that resource or have that available to them and can integrate that into their daily lives, they'll see improvements in their health.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Acosta on IndianCountryTV.com, and we're here on the Shakopee Minnewaukan Sioux community, and they're working on their organic farm, and we're here with Lori Watzel. She's a tribal member here, Can you share with us about how you guys got started with the farm?
Sure. Mittawakinton Wazupi was started in the spring of 2010, and it's a natural outgrowth of the tribe's efforts to not only care for our land and our resources, at the same time caring for tribal members. This certified organic garden is grown in ways that nourish the land and give back to the land. That nourishes us, and we have this very nice relationship going. It's an outgrowth of many efforts that the tribe is making recently to do what's right for the earth and for its members.
And what do you guys do after all the vegetables are grown? Where do they go?
Last year, the tribe supported the building of a root cellar. So just to the across the driveway here, there's a nice root cellar, so there are lots of vegetables that are harvested late in the year that are kept there, potatoes and squash and onions, things like that.
And you guys have a farmer's market where they go and sell the product and also a store, correct?
Yes, Mittawakinton Wazupi sends produce to Mazopia, which is the tribe's natural food store, and they hold a farmer's market every Thursday morning from 9 to 1, where they bring the produce over and sell outside the store.
How many acres do you guys have here, and how much did you start with?
In the spring of 2010, we started with about an acre and a half, grew out an acre and a half of produce. We had a wonderful year. It was very successful. We've got a wonderful gardener, and we had a wonderful season, so it all came together very well. In fact, last year we did 3 produce sales a week and had great success with that. Now this year we've expanded to nearly 5.5 acres, but about 5 of that is grown in produce. There's always a portion of the garden that's left to kind of regenerate. There are cover crops grown on it that nourish the soil like I was talking about earlier and give it time to rest. So about 5 acres right now of organic produce. We also have an organic orchard where we have native fruit trees and shrubs, and this year the introduction of some apple trees. And I think that there's about, Rebecca can correct me on this, but I think that there's about maybe 4 acres that's dedicated to that.
How did you get involved as a tribal member with?
Well, my background is in health, and I had left the tribe for a little while my husband and I, to do our own business venture. And when we came back, it was natural for me to come back into an area of health and working for the tribe. And I, at that point in my life, I was becoming very aware and more conscious of what I was eating and what those foods contained. You know, lots of processed foods, lots of refined foods that aren't good for any of us. I was learning more about that and putting together this cause and effect. I was beginning to understand better this cause and effect of what we eat, what it does to us. And thinking about our community members, thinking about all Native people and the chronic health conditions that we deal with at such disproportionate levels, you know, compared to other populations. And many of those chronic conditions, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity, arthritis even, can be addressed with clean, healthy food. If people have that resource or have that available to them and can integrate that into their daily lives, they'll see improvements in their health. One of the ways that our garden grew this year was the development of a TSA program. TSA stands for Tribally Supported Agriculture. It's the same type of program that you may have heard of called CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture. What happens is that people, we offer this to our tribal members and employees at first, and they purchase a share of the garden at the beginning of the season. They make an investment into the garden. And then when things start coming up, are producing, they get a weekly 3/4 bushel box of produce. So in our instance, for 18 weeks, they'll get a weekly delivery of organic produce.
That's really neat. So then that way it encourages them to stay healthy because they've invested into this.
That's right. That's right. And we really want to support people utilizing this food, and much of it's new to people. We grow many, many different varieties here, and much of it new to people. So in addition to getting the weekly delivery, they also can participate in weekly TSA cooking classes where we demonstrate to them how to use some of the vegetables that are in the box.
Do any of them come out here and volunteer their time in the garden?
Yes, yes. Rebecca has scheduled some days for volunteer activity. That's happened, and now we do have a couple people who are coming out on a more regular basis to help in the garden, and we really need help in the garden. It's a big project.
And we have Rebecca here, and we're going to talk to her about the details of the whole gardening process, correct?
That sounds great, yes. Thanks, Kimberly.
Thank you. We're with Rebecca Yoshino. She's the gardener here at the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux Community's garden. Can you tell us about what kinds of seeds you use and the different products that you guys have planted here?
Well, we have well over 150 different varieties of vegetables, berries, and melons, so I guess fruit. Many of the varieties that we're growing are heirloom seeds or heritage seeds. Some of them were actually gifted to us from a local native nonprofit local to the Twin Cities area called Dream of Wild Health. And they gave us some heritage corn, squash, and bean seeds, which we're growing in our Three Sisters garden. Some of the seeds we save from year to year and replant, and then some of our varieties are hybrid varieties that we purchase from different seed sources.
What makes you certified organic? What do you do?
We have to comply with national organic standards, and we work with a certification agency that comes out every year to make sure that we are abiding by our organic systems plan, which has been pre-approved by this, MOSA is who we're certified through. And what that entails is that we don't use any synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, insecticides out here, that we try to source as many of our seeds organic as possible, that we never use treated seeds or GMO seeds, that we use cover crops, have a good soil fertility plan, and crop rotate. So all of our crops we rotate from year to year.
And how many people do you have out here helping you with that, or do you do it all by yourself?
Thank goodness I don't do it all by myself. We have 2.5 full-time employees here. And then we get additional hours from the land department, which is part of the Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community workforce.
What's your favorite part about being out here gardening?
I love harvesting. I love harvesting beautiful produce and being able to distribute that to the community. So I think that's probably my favorite part.
And what's your favorite crop that you like?
Oh, boy. Well, we did harvest sweet corn this week, first harvest of the season, and there's nothing better than fresh sweet corn warmed by the sun, eating it raw out in the field. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Never tried something like that.
Well, you have an opportunity to do that here if you want.
Is there anything else you want to share with us about the importance of organic farming?
I think that it is an incredibly important way to farm. The food is much more healthy for people to consume. The footprint on the earth is a lot less. And it is very important to conserve our soil quality as well for future generations, and that's something that is part of the National Organic Protocol. So,
do you rotate your fields?
We do rotate our fields. We take parts of fields out of production for a season or part of a season. We use compost out here and as many green manure crops as we can. And those are crops that are grown specifically to help feed the soil. So they're grown, we mow them, we till them into the soil, and that basically feeds the soil, its structure, soil structure, and all of the microbial and biological life there.
This is called Temptation, and it is a 65-day sweet corn. So it matures earlier than our other sweet corn varieties, and so the ears don't get as big. It's bicolor, it's white and yellow, and it is incredibly sweet. This we harvested this week for our TSA and for the farmer's market, and the raccoons got a little bit of it too, but this is just the leftovers right here. And then this variety right here, it's still a sweet, but it's not quite ready. But look at the size of those ears. This will be ready next week.
That's
and this
pretty.
Is called Silver King. And it's a white sweet corn, and it is absolutely delicious as well. So hopefully we will get more of this than the raccoons and the worms. No worms in these guys.
That ain't any good. You want a refund?
You want this one?
Oh, that's delicious. That
oh, it's
delicious.
Really good.
Anybody want any more? I'll take that one. Incredibly important way to farm. The food is much more healthy for people to consume. The footprint on the earth is a lot less. And it is very important to conserve our soil quality as well for future generations, and that's something that is part of the National Organic Protocol.
And today, the identity that we're focusing on is the Minnewaukan Kenton brand. Let's name the podcast, the title of the podcast, which we're doing a focus today on the Minnewaukan tribe, which is a sub-tribe of the Sioux Nation in Minnesota. And they, as you just heard, they have they grow their own food. And they have at times three farmers markets a year where they sell that food, generating revenue for their community. And they set up community-based businesses, which I consider real social security, real social services, because they do it within this. They're basically independent. Before we go to the phone lines here, they also are into gaming. So let's listen to what the gaming and some other business enterprises. Like I said, they set up community-based businesses.
But tribal government gaming is providing for communities that have had a history of struggle. In addition to that, the things we're strategizing on at the National Indian Gaming Association is to continue to build our economies.
Hello, I'm Kimberly with Indian Country TV, and I'm here with Ernie Stevens Jr., the chairman of the National Indian Gaming Association. He's going on his eighth term and 15 years with the organization. Tell me about what you just had a conference that was just held.
Yeah, San Diego, California. Probably close to 7,000 of our folks from the industry were there. And mostly we talked about legislation and a lot of our priorities in Indian gaming. We had a lot of business things going on. A lot of great things happening, a lot of training and things we're really excited about what happened in San Diego. It was, again, our record numbers, and we always say it's the biggest trade show ever, but this one literally in terms of statistics and numbers and actual presence was our largest show in our history.
How does it feel to have Indian Country bringing you back for an eighth term?
Well, you know, it's everything that I live for, not so much being in this capacity, but being able to help people. I watch both of my parents help people. I watch my grandparents, my aunts and uncles help people. I watch my brothers and sisters and my children help people. That's what we do. So to be in this capacity, I would never have imagined that I would be starting my 15th year in this capacity, but it gives us an opportunity to fight for Indian people and to fight for tribal sovereignty and stand in favor of things that are great. There's a big gaming world out there, but our world is tribal government gaming, and we are supplying needs very much. We are supplying needed things to our communities, and so that's the difference. And we, you know, Las Vegas is cool. We have nothing to say bad about Las Vegas or Atlantic City, and anything like that. But tribal government gaming is providing for communities that have had a history of struggle. In addition to that, the things we're strategizing on at the National Indian Gaming Association is to continue to build our economies. And with that, we're going to have to figure out how to do it with and beyond just gaming. So a lot of discussion on economic development as well. That's one of the key components that we discussed, and we unveiled a study that we're doing to strategize on how we can continue to move Indian gaming forward, but also do it with and beyond other ideas and thoughts on economic development. A lot of tribes out there don't have the market. Some of them just being able to create jobs. some of them don't have any gaming, and we have to figure out how to help them, how to stand with them. All of them are strong, all of them are powerful, all of them have a great and beautiful communities, but jobs are not visible in many of them. So we have to create jobs. That's our bottom line.
What are some examples of the efforts you guys are working on with different tribes across the country?
Well, I think that, you know, protecting our communities through the legislation and safeguarding any legislation. I think that one of the key victories in Indian Country was not a National Indian Gaming victory or any individual victory. It was a unified approach in protecting our rights as governments to supply education and general welfare benefits to our tribal members. And we were a little bit under oppressed by the Internal Revenue Service to tax government services and government-provided items. And it was getting to be with education and health care benefits and different things like that. It was a major thing for us. We banded together and we fought this fight, and it culminated in the general welfare exclusion, a law that went through in the fall time that protects tribes. It was a major, major victory for us, and we will never know how much we preserved for Indian Country by winning this victory. And again, it was a unified victory in Indian Country. And from the standpoint of having to be under that kind of siege in with tribal governments, that's one thing. But to even have to fight that fight, tribes have been recognized as governments since the United States Constitution was established. A lot of the rules and things that the United States go by were established through their study of a lot of the tribal governments, how they operated. So it's key that governments should not be taxed. And we established that, and we won that victory. And, you know, from my father, who lives in the nursing home, his standpoint was we should never been fighting it. And it's something that we should never been having to spend so much energy doing to protecting our right to provide to our government, to our communities through tribal government gaming. It's a battle that never should have had to fight, but yet because we were fighting, it was that significant because we won that battle. We won that battle through education and standing together and provided for our tribes.
There's a lot of issues going around Indian Country with mining. There's been some victories and not some victories. You want to talk about NIGA's involvement with any of that?
Yeah, I think that this is a very serious issue for us. And, you know, well, we've had some excellent developments here in northern Wisconsin, but it's been a major battle for us. And, you know, I really take a look at it from the standpoint, well, all the Native American family, and many of which are non-Indians too, helping us fight this fight because they understand the value of this land that we walk on. It's not about money. It's about preservation. It's about our being able to survive in this land we call the Turtle Island. And so while we've taken a giant step forward here in northern Wisconsin, we take a setback in Arizona at Oak Flat. And so NIGA has a resolution, and we've been working with all the tribes across the country because there's no regional aspect here. If they're coming after Mother Earth in northern Wisconsin or Arizona or California or wherever, it's a fight for all of us. And so this Oak Flat victory for the mining company is a setback for us. But to think that we are not, or that we're out of the picture, that we're going to sit back and watch this happen, that's not the case. The tribes continue to fight and educate and stand strong. We've had ceremony and a lot of different discussions. We've had folks that have actually been right to the site. And, you know, what we're trying to do is just trying to stand strong. And it's still like GWE or anything else like that. It's educating America about how wrong this is. You just don't go and you don't do what they want to do to Mother Earth any place, in my opinion. But this is sacred sites. This is where, for time immemorial, that we've had our ceremony and our burial grounds and things like that. It may be normal for some aspects in history that for people who just could live with themselves by desecrating these sites. but it's never been normal for any country. Sacred is sacred. And so we continue this battle here and any place else where people continue to desecrate and show a common disrespect for our culture, our way of life. And I think the best way to describe it is that we respect all cultures. Our parents, our tradition, our generations have always taught us to, whether it's the church or whatever denomination, whatever religion, we respect one another. And right here, it's a sad day and time that in 2015, we are fighting this fight. It's really a sad time. But we'll be polite and cordial, but we will not stand down. We're going to continue to fight for Mother Earth.
What are some of the efforts you have coming up in your next term?
Well, I think that getting this economic development study done is a high priority. Continuing to monitor the world of internet gaming. It's a subject that is continuing, a subject that people seem to be one minute to want to do an opposed to it, but then they want to carve out some certain industries. What we're saying about internet is, I personally don't think it's going to be save the world economically, but that's not my job to decide that. If folks see that as a prominent economic development arm, then so be it. Then if we can create jobs and create opportunity for tribes, then we have to move forward with that. And to that extent, so I don't think it saves American economy, but I think it adds to not just American economy, but to our tribal economy. But it's not fair if you write that, if you carve anybody out, you got to respect the tribes, respect the tribal compacts, respect that you cannot tax tribes, and respect our ability to regulate that industry. So we have a standing position, several points that our tribes have established through many meetings, and we'll continue to meet on that. We're going to meet on it again next month at the Great Plains Indian Gaming, Great Plains and Midwest Indian Gaming Conference. So we're going to keep monitoring this and keep trying to stay focused on it. And wherever we can create opportunity for economic development, we want to stay focused. But right now, the thoughts and ideas around it are again like an imbalance to favoring some folks, but kind of leaving the potentially, I'm not accusing anybody of anything, potentially leaving our economies out in the cold on this. So if they want to do a ban on internet gaming, then ban it. But if they're going to carve anybody out, we want to be at the front line, because we're sovereign tribal governments, and we can utilize this to the best advantage and be effective at it, and be a very clean and regulated industry as well. So we'll just kind of wait and see.
Is there any message you would like to leave with Indian country, or anything that we've left out?
I think Mother Earth is our message today, and while we're advocate and standing strong for tribal government gaming, I think that as we head into the springtime, we relish as the leaves start to turn green, and I think Mother Earth is always beautiful, but springtime is special. Springtime brings us graduations and family gatherings and things like that. So, I think we just head into the spring and do a lot of great things. But in Washington, D.C., we will be on the front line. And as long as Congress is in session, tribes from all over the country will be there educating and statesmanlike and providing the kind of education that Washington needs to understand and appreciate why we stand so firm. And not just protecting tribal sovereignty, not just protecting our communities, but what we need to do is build our communities, build them forward. And there's a lot of challenges out in this world related to our teenagers, our young folks. Well, we got to provide for them. We got to help them understand their role, because the best leaders in Indian country helping young people are the young people themselves. So we want to press forward with thinking about our young people, thinking about our community, and while we stand and fight for sovereignty and fight for our community, we have a real strong young population. We want to provide them an opportunity to build to the next generations to come. So I'm a big advocate for understanding and appreciating young people, no matter where they are in their life. And I think that they can continue to help themselves, And again, we have so many challenges in different communities with our young young folks. I call them young leaders because they're their own role models in this world. So I think in the springtime it's kind of has that mode of school and finishing out the year and coming together. It's beautiful. But standing strong and appreciating our community and helping young folks and rebuilding, that's the key here. So we're excited about that. I'm always excited about spring. And, you know, when I got elected 14 years ago, I said to the constituency, to the member tribes, that my campaign is my work. So I don't have a lot of signs or a lot of buttons, anything like that. We'll get hit the ground running. And I looked at the newspaper the other day. The last time I was home was March 23rd.
Oh.
So I'm trying to get home tonight. I'm not sure I'm going to make it. But, again, we won't stay long. We'll just keep working. My job is in Washington, D.C. My job is right here in the heart of Indian country. This is one of the most beautiful places in the whole world right here in Lac-Couturier. This is where my job is. It's one of the greatest honors. Every time I get to community, even sometimes it's celebrations, sometimes it's sad times. I've been to a couple of funeral services, and sometimes it's sad, but nonetheless, it's an honor to stand with Indian country, to be in the heart of Indian country. So when I get back to Washington, D.C., I know who I represent and what I stand for. I stand for those elders. I stand for those communities. I stand for their education. That's what I stand for. So I'm excited about getting back to work, and again, my campaign is my work.
Well, thank you for joining me, Kimberly Acosta with Indian Country TV.
Okay, today's podcast is titled
Regional Aspect here. If they're coming after Mother Earth in northern Wisconsin.
Today's podcast is titled The Manawakan Brand. We're concentrating on the Manawakan Tribe, which is a sub-tribe of the Sioux Nation up in Minnesota. We'll be back with more information after some holiday cheer with, well, as a matter of fact, this is semi-cheer from Ray Charles.
You know my baby, she won't let me in. I've got a few pennies, I'm gonna buy myself a bottle of gin, and then I'm gonna call my buddy on the telephone and say, so hard all day long. Everything I try to do seems to always turn out wrong. That's why I want to stop by on my way home and say, now let me tell you one more thing. Have a little taste, but don't lose your cool and start messing up the man's place. Ain't no harm, take a little nip, but don't you fall down and bust your lip. No, no. Everybody ought to come on and go with me.
Okay, let's give more information on Amanda Walken tribe, which is out in Minnesota. Pretty interesting. Anyway, the Minnewaukin, let's see, it's a sub-tribe, but one of the sub-tribes of the Sioux Nation. Let's see, I'm skipping through a lot of this on, they're on 2,000 acres. They started out with, like, I think, 250 acres. Let's see, they have a website. If you go to the Shakopee, that's spelled S-H-A-K-O-P-E-E, Minnewaukin Sioux Community. And Minnewaukin is spelled M-D-E-W-A-K-A-N-T-O-N. Sioux spelled S-I-O-U-X Community. They have a website. And then some of the links you can press on, they have one link for their culture, which has its subdivisions. Government, they govern themselves, so the government and the departments, conservation and enforcement. They have another tab for economy there, and if you click on enterprises, they have, let's see, yeah, I like their layout. They have, for recreation and entertainment, and this is part of their enterprise, they have the Meadows at Mystic Lake. They have a fitness center. They've got an ice center for hockey and things like hockey, skating, things of that nature. They have a live link center. They got like two casinos. They have the Mystic Lake Casino Hotel, and they have the Little Six Casino. All this is laid out on their page, or their particular website. And these are community-based businesses. Okay, well, let's see as we now the last audio we heard. Now their two casinos are part of the National Indian Gaming Association. The National Gaming Association. Let's see. Let's get some numbers for you. Revenue, they're taking like over $37 billion a year. And I believe they have, it's over 100, I think over 150 tribes that are members of the National Indian Gaming Association. And let's see, hold it, let me get more information for you. But the National Indian Gaming Association, like I said, this particular tribe has two casinos. Okay, the exact membership is 135 member tribes. They have 198 associate members. Let's see. Like I said, they're taking over $37 billion. And essentially what they do is they create job, any needs that they take care of themselves, bottom line. But they have an excellent, I like their business plan or what have you. Okay, so let me see. Let's go to the phone lines, take a call. 314,
Michael. Yeah, Italy, I wanted to tell you yesterday that They found a tiny house there in Missouri that was stolen.
Where did they find it?
In House Spring, Missouri, believe it or not. That's the name of the town.
Okay. I guess
but
it was still intact, man.
Yeah, she had apparently hooked up to the trailer hitch, and what she should have done was have a means to set it on legs, extend some legs. You can put up a hydraulic situation that would do that and take the wheels off. They won't nobody be able to.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Take the wheels off and also put a hidden GPS in there too. How did they find it? They mention that?
There was a sheriff down in Jefferson County. Well, I don't know what county that is, but there's a sheriff down there in House Springs, and it's where they found it. But so all was well on that. But on this thing with these reservations, and I guess the federal government was trying to tax their gaming revenue.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that works with states.
Depending on how the, I guess it depends on how, there's a lot more to it than I've found out so far. But you're right, that's, they're trying to tax gaming revenue.
Well, you know, the thing is the only other thing that states collecting revenue would be lotto and lottery proceeds. I don't know of any states that run casinos. So it depends on how they recognize how they are recognized. I would think, and also the people that do the winning.
Speaking of gaming, do you know of any African Americans that own casinos? I don't know if he's still living. A guy named Barton. He had a riverboat casino, but I don't know if he's still alive though.
Well, you know, when they put casinos, I think it was either in Detroit or New Jersey. I think it was some blacks that was trying to position himself to own some for the very reason, but I don't know how successful that ended up. You know, the same thing was with
Don Barton. Yeah, Don Barton. He died in 2011. I know he partnered up with Michael Jackson when they were to try to get a bid on a casino in Detroit. But for some reason, they were, I guess they didn't have enough political clout. So they couldn't get a casino in. But he was the only African-American I knew that was in. But like I said, he had a riverboat operation. But like he passed in 2011.
And that was a book that was put out having to do with cable coming to Los Angeles. And I can't think of the name of the book. I got the book, but it was very interesting. They told the players, people that was behind, trying to cash in on what eventually became a lucrative market during its infancy stages. But I don't know what to say about this so-called Indian land. I think it's federal government. If businesses want to exploit that land for whatever lay on there, eventually they will do it. And, if you can't do something with it nowadays in time, somebody else will come along and do it themselves. If they had to defend that themselves, if it wasn't the U.S., and they were left there to defend that themselves, then the same would play out with any other adversary that come along, whether it was Jamaica, whether it was Nigeria or whoever. People, that's what other nations do. If you whatever you got to be able to defend it. And you know, another thing on this thing about GMOs and organic food, mm-hmm. I was talking to a geneticist, a guy who's him and another person been working on a cure for pancreatic cancer. And Eddie is about ready to go into trials. And we got to talking about organic foods and stuff. You know what he told me? He said the body, it don't make no difference how those foods are grown. The body is going to take the cellular structure in your body is going to take out certain things and pass the rest of it away anyway. You know how people talk about drinking alkaline water, how people talk about eating foods that's produced by compost rather than ammonia, nitrates, and so forth. The body's on the food is only looking for certain elements. Whether those elements come right. through natural decay or whether the elements come from you going to the market and buying fertilizer and pouring on it. Nitrogen, potassium, and phosphates are what they are, how they are delivered. It may cause an organism to have to work harder to get it out, but it's going to break it down and take out what it needs and pass the rest of it away. But
that's what the body does. It has its own intelligence.
Yeah. But anyway, I can't add too much more to that subject. I sit back and listen and see what others have to say.
Well, it's kind of like today. I guess it's Friday. When's Christmas? Tuesday?
Well, today's the 21st. So it'll be 4 days from today. 22nd, 23rd, 24th. Tuesday, yeah. Would be
okay.
Christmas.
Well, like I say, these, I guess not all of them, not all Native American tribes have the same, community-based businesses, but I think that would be, I know they're like 1,200, how do they phrase it? Black towns, settlements. There's 1,200 of them. Not all of them are. Only a small portion of that 1,200 are actual municipalities. Most of them are rural. I think one, probably, maybe more than two, have colleges, one out in Oklahoma. I believe Grambling's in a black town. Which is, I think, as a matter of fact, is Grambling considered a black town?
Grambling University? Is there a Grambling, Alabama?
No, that's in Louisiana. Oh, I'm looking it up now. Grambling University. Grambling University, Grambling State University. Let's see, Grambling. Who is it? Because I passed through there one time on a bus. I didn't even know what just ended up. Yeah, it's in Grambling, Louisiana. So, all right, Grambling is a city in Lincoln Parish, Louisiana. What's the demographics here? 97, all right, you may as well call it the black town. 97.1% African American, 1% white, 0.11%, anyway, 97% African American. So, yeah, Grambling, I think it is a black township in Oklahoma, that has a university. Yes, some do have businesses, but like Taft used to have businesses, grocery stores and all that other stuff, but now they're down to five churches.
Well, Grambling would be a good place because Louisiana, for retirees anyway, because of the Homestead Act that Louisiana enjoys.
Right. Well, not only
my. Yeah,
they're looking for affordable housing, because like in, well, a lot of, well, the ones I know about in Oklahoma that I've been to or near, they're, well, let's go by the churches here. a lot of people that attend those churches might live as far as 45 minutes away. So they'll come to Taft, but they might live in Tulsa, 45 minutes away. Muskogee is 10, 15 minutes away by car. So, yeah, retirees or people looking for affordable housing, depending how, you market it. But like you said, it'll have to be marketed different today than it was originally marketed, you know, to just establish those towns. So,
I'd rather live in Louisiana, more conducive weather. You got ports, the ocean, Mississippi River. There's opportunities for seafood business, opportunities for probably timber. A lot of those properties down there has gas deposits on it also. So if you got a 97% population, then those who want to have those type of paradigms, well, there it is. There's a basin. What do you think?
It comes down to, my whole thing is, you go to a place and how does it feel to you? Is this place home? Because in Oklahoma, at least, well, the part I know about, there's, for what I want to do, everything's there. So, Louisiana, and I spent some time in Louisiana. Man, the humidity, it gets to me. Opportunities anywhere, you really just comes to mindset, and, you know, if you can recognize it.
Mm-hmm. Grambling's at the northern end of the state, just east of Shreveport.
Right.
So it's up in North Louisiana.
Right. All right, we're going to, let's see, play, I got to take something on the Black Russian here. We'll be back, after the Black Russian.
Welcome to the Culture Report, Voice of Russia, America's weekly look into the world of arts, culture, and history. I'm Rob Sachs. In his new book, The Black Russian, Yale historian Vladimir Alexandrov chronicles the story of Frederick Bruce Thomas from the fields of Mississippi to the streets of Moscow. Voice of Russia New York correspondent Vasily Sushko met up with Alexandrov and brings us this interview.
Immediately obvious to you that his life merits a biography. What attracted you most, the amazing personality of Frederick Thomas, or was it the colorful historical backdrop of Founder-sick Europe and Russia?
It was the complete unlikeliness that somebody who was black would be in Moscow before the First World War and apparently very successful. Russia simply had virtually no black people of any kind living there permanently. In those days, the days when American black writers and actors like Paul Robeson most famously went to the Soviet Union were still decades in the future. So it was the surprising nature of this fact that interested me. And I've always been drawn to the period just before the revolution. It was a very rich period in Russian history and culture, so that added to the interest.
Let's talk about the major episodes of Frederick Thomas's life. Frederick Thomas's origins were inauspicious. However, his parents were remarkably entrepreneurial and hardy people, something you write Thomas must have learned from. Tell us a few words about Frederick's parents.
Oh, it's definitely the case that Thomas got his wings from his parents because they had been slaves until the end of the Civil War in Mississippi. The flight of freedmen immediately after the Civil War was a difficult one, but Thomas's parents managed in 1869, 4 years after the Civil War ended, to buy at auction a 200-acre farm in Mississippi, which immediately put them into a very small minority of black landowners. That was one remarkable achievement on their part. Another thing that they did that showed a real commitment toward their community was that a decade later, they donated an acre of land to found an African Methodist Episcopal Church, which was the black church of the region. Things continued in the same way. They increased the size of their farm from 200 acres to over 600 acres over the years. They started out branch businesses, in some cases collaborating with white people who lived in the area. And then when, in 1886, a rich white farmer, fundamentally for racist reasons, tried to seize their land, they fought back in court. And they actually managed to win the first phase of the legal process. So this kind of commitment to one's own interests, this kind of originality that they showed, is something that Thomas obviously learned from them as well, and it carried him through his life, including his remarkable adventures in Russia and later in Turkey.
At the age of 18, Frederick leaves the southern U.S. for Chicago and New York. Was he motivated by the desire to escape the racism in the South, or was he driven more by intense wanderlust and the desire to make something of himself?
I think both. He experienced a different form of life than he knew in rural Mississippi when he wound up in Memphis, Tennessee in 1890. He went to school there, a school that was founded by liberally minded white people from the North. So I think that he saw that there were other kinds of people in the United States than the ones he was exposed to in the white dominated South where he originated from. But he also said in a memoir that I found that he wanted to see something of the world. And he did something very unusual for a young black man in those days. He went north. In the end of the 19th century, that's not what young black men usually did. The Great Migration, which happened at the end of the First World War during the 20s and 30s, was still decades ahead. So Frederick Thomas went to Chicago, which had a minuscule black population in those days, between 1 and 2%. He worked there for a while. Then he went to New York City, which also had a tiny black population in those days. So he began very quickly to break the mold and to try new things, in a desire to, I think, find greater freedom for himself and also to spread his wings in sort of new locales.
In his early 20s, Frederick Thomas leaves for Europe, first London, then Paris, and then a score of other places. You write that he often worked as a waiter for short periods of time before moving on to another city or country. What was it about Frederick Thomas that helped him to find employment so easily?
Being a waiter is a wonderfully portable profession. Once you learn how to be a good waiter and the demands on waiters at the best restaurants in Chicago and New York, where Thomas worked in the 1890s, were very high. Then you had learned the ropes that you could then exploit anywhere. And so the evidence that I found shows that he was able to find employment pretty much anytime he wanted at upscale places in various major European cities and resort areas. And this allowed him to travel widely. If you look at a map of Europe over the years that he traveled through Europe from about 1894 through 1899 to 1900, he zigzagged from north to south to east and west, being everywhere that was interesting and important.
Frederick Thomas comes to Russia in 1899, and that's where he decides to settle. Do we know as to his reasons for choosing Russia of all places in Europe?
It seems that he was employed by a charismatic nobleman, and there are possibilities that it might have even been a member of the Russian imperial family, a Grand Duke, because there's evidence that Thomas worked in Monte Carlo in the late 1890s, which was one of the favorite spots for Russian Grand Dukes to burn through the empire's money as they had a good time. And so he was taken to Russia as the personal servant of a nobleman. And after that, it seems probably the case that he liked Moscow in particular because of how mixed it was in terms of ethnicities. There were people from all over the Russian Empire. Not everyone's eyes were round, not everyone's skin was white. And so although statistically there were very few people of any kind of African origin in Russia in those days, he didn't stand out as much as one might expect. because of the variety of ethnic types that you could see, especially on Moscow city streets.
Vladimir, you write in the book, quote, "For Frederick and the Moscovites, money and personal flair trumped ethnicity or race, with the glaring exception of Jews. It's remarkable that a black man of humble origin yet formidable talents and drive could make such a success of himself in Russia, a success that would have been next to impossible for him in the United States at the time. Yet millions of Jews were leaving Russia for America and Europe because of widespread anti-Semitism in the Russian Empire. In fact, the Pale of Settlement was not that dissimilar to the Jim Crow laws, just like pogroms were to mass lynchings of the American South. In your opinion, was Frederick Thomas aware of this dark irony?
There are certainly parallels of the sort that you mentioned between the status of blacks in Jim Crow America and the status of Jews in the Russian Empire. I'm assuming, I don't have any direct evidence for it, but I'm assuming that Thomas sensed this. And the reason for this is that he actually fostered, during the First World War, the staging of a play that originated in the United States that was sympathetic to Jews. And I think for a black man with his past, to go so against the grain of the norms in Russia at the time, the norms being generally an anti-Semitic attitude, and to help the staging of a play that showed Jewish people in a positive light, indicates some degree of awareness on his part of the fact that there were these ironic similarities between blacks in the United States and Jews in Russia.
Frederick Thomas's rise to success, fame, and prosperity was rather swift in Russia, first as a maitre d' in the finest Moscow restaurants, and then as a co-owner of the most famous variety theaters of the time, such as the Aquarium Gardens and Maxim. In your biography, he comes across as a very dignified, charming, and courteous man. However, running a massive entertainment business in early 20th century Moscow was no walk in the park. He must have been incredibly tough and even cunning, no?
Absolutely. He was a real wheeler dealer when he had to be. And I found wonderful evidence for this in a French archive, which is correspondence between a Russian lawyer who had been hired by a French copyright agency to get Russian entertainment tycoons like Frederick Thomas in Moscow to pay royalties on the French music that they performed. And the numerous letters that I found in which the Russian lawyer reports back to his bosses about how it's going with Thomas show that Thomas played him. He played him like a skillful fisherman plays a fish on a hook, by promising to pay him at some point, then finding an excuse not to. He kept the French lawyer running around for 3.5 to 4 years without paying him a kopeck. And this was obviously a tactic that Thomas used on other occasions as well. Moreover, when the First World War began, prohibition was proclaimed in Russia, much as it would be in the United States a few years later. That's when Thomas made the most money of all, because he obviously participated in bootlegging enterprises and sold all kinds of liquor, as everybody else was doing who was savvy about these things. So yes, he certainly was a cunning man, in addition to being a dignified and a kind man.
What would one expect to enjoy in establishments run by Frederick Thomas? You quote a contemporary describing the aquarium as, quote, "a perfectly respectable operetta theater, an equally respectable open-air music hall, a definitely less respectable café chantant, and the inevitable chain of private cabinets for gypsy singing and private carouses."
Yeah, that's the full range. In other words, a place like the Aquarium Garden, which was several acres of park-like land near the center of Moscow, a remnant of the place still exists today, would have various venues that people could attend. They could go to a theater and see an operetta or a light comedy, which would be perfectly fine for husbands to take their wives to. They could go to another stage and see a vaudeville show with everything from operatic singers warbling away to trained animal acts, to trick bicycle riders, to comedians. That would also be something that you could bring your spouse to. However, there were also more risque acts that would appear at a later time on that stage. There would be chorus girls who would do song and dance numbers. Much of the attraction that these chorus girls had for their clients was that they were pretty and flirtatious. And it was in keeping with the norms of the time that a client who had booked for himself and for his friends a private room from which they could see the stage could send a note to a performer who particularly appealed to them, and she would be expected to go join them in their private room for a continuation of the party. Now, what that exactly entailed, of course, varied, but it obviously involved an atmosphere of sexual license up to a point. Although Thomas himself knew this world and lived in it, it's interesting that he did not exploit performers in the same way that some other owners of entertainment venues did. In fact, I found a memoir of a Russian young woman who performed in a place where Thomas worked, and she remembered him as looking out for her and letting her, for example, sit at a table with guests, but being sure that she didn't have too much to drink and being sure that she could get home afterwards safely.
Frederick Thomas manages to escape Russia, which was in the grip of the Civil War in 1919 with almost nothing in his pockets, yet he manages to reinvent himself in Istanbul and once again succeed remarkably. And yet his end was rather tragic. Could you say a few words about what brought Frederick Thomas's final undoing?
Sure. Let me just sketch briefly the difficulties that he endured. He did, with a lot of trouble, get out of Moscow in the summer of 1918, made it to Odessa, which in those days was under German occupation. He had property there, too. But he did lose all of his money when he finally had to escape the approaching Bolsheviks in April of 1919. He remembered that he had about $25 to his name, which, even given the currency changes since those days, wasn't very much, just a few hundred dollars. He went into terrible debt in Constantinople to open his first entertainment venue. It took him a number of years to be able to establish himself, but he did establish himself within 3 years as the owner of the premier nightclub for Constantinople and actually for that part of the world. So fame about him spread. And, for example, American tourists used to come to Constantinople in the 1920s on cruise ships, and they would be amazed that there was this elegant, rich, by then, black American running the fanciest nightclub in Constantinople. They would write about this in articles in newspapers back home or write letters to the editor. But Thomas could not escape the long reach of American racism when he was in Constantinople. He had to deal with the American diplomats at the Consulate General in Constantinople, and they refused to recognize his American origins, so that when, in 1923, the Turkish Republic was proclaimed, Thomas became stateless because his former Russian citizenship meant nothing. The Americans wouldn't give him their recognition as an American. The new Turkish government was opposed to letting foreigners have much freedom in their new republic. So he was left without the protection of the American diplomats. He also became extravagant once he made a lot of money and would throw it around. And there was competition from Turkish organized entertainment venues that siphoned clients away from him. And so his debts returned. They got worse. His property was seized. He tried to escape from Constantinople by going to Angora, or Ankara, as the capital is now called. He was imprisoned, he fell ill, and he died, sick and penniless, in Constantinople in 1928.
When reading The Black Russian, I was struck by how cinematic the book felt.
There is something cinematic about Thomas's life, the sweep of it as he moves from one exotic locale to another, the kind of events that took place in the background, the Russian Revolution unfolding in Moscow when Thomas was there. I thought that somebody like Denzel Washington would make a terrific actor, and it should be shot on location in Moscow.
Vladimir Alexandrov, thank you very much for taking the time for being with us on the Russian Book World.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And our thanks to Voice of Russia's New York correspondent, Vasily Shushko, for that interview.
Okay, and that was on the Black Russian. You should have basically, well, you know, hindsight's 2020 vision, decades later. You should have went, instead of, well, couldn't stay in Russia, so go more east. He went to Turkey, which parts of that are considered Eastern Europe, but he should have gone further. This place is like Romania. Anyway, but I'm talking several decades later. Let's go to phone lines here. 336, your mic is open.
Greetings, Brother L.A., can you hear me?
Yes.
Greetings, Grand Risings. Is that on YouTube?
Yep. Just type in Black Russian.
Okay, I'm going to do that. So they have several about his life?
Oof, I can't remember. I mean, well, there's a book. If you go on Amazon and type in Black Russian, there's a book titled Black Russian, because on YouTube, when you if you type in Black Russian, you'll probably find everyday people. You got blacks in Russia, so you might find somebody that just black that moved over to Russia, that students there, whatever. So there's a black presence in Russia. So there's several. Actually, there's several black people that have videos. They happen to be black, and they just live in Russia. So if you go to Amazon and type in Black Russian in the Amazon, the book section, Kindle book section, then the book will pop up, and it goes into detail about him. And then you can – he's got a video or two about him on YouTube, though, but there's more videos on blacks who – have visited Russia, or some do live and work in Russia.
Oh, okay. So if I punch in his name and say Black Russian, it should come up. That's really interesting. I can see a whole lot in that, Brother L.A., him in this lifetime and being drawn. Where I'm going with this is metaphysically reincarnation. Yeah, I can see that, even due to the fact why I'm here, where I am now at Fort Huachuca. It's a lot. So thank you for bringing this to my attention. I appreciate it. Thank us. I'll listen. Peace.
No problem. It's kind of like today, so, because, you know, people holiday shopping, that type thing. Hold on. I'm trying to go back to. But anyway, so today we covered the identity, the primary identity for today. We took a Native American tribe, the Minnewaukan tribe, which is a sub-tribe of the Sioux Nation up in Minnesota. They're on, I believe, 2,000 acres of land. I think they started with like 250, but they're up to 2,000, I think, acres of land. They've got, they're self-contained. They have their own government. I think the tribe's population is 650 people. And actually they have, you know, people, if you go to their website, it's something that people, it's duplicatable. In Oklahoma, I know in Muskogee County, you've got a couple of black townships, and there is a Native American tribe that has a casino and hotel resort in the city of Muskogee. So, there's a lot of models out there that people can pick and choose from on which way they want to go. So, on that note, unless somebody else has something to say here, because we're on this holiday thing, so kind of slow today. But we'll be here on Monday. We might be on Sunday with a special sports edition. But on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends.
Crush your morning goals with a steak, egg, and cheese bagel or any breakfast sandwich and snag another one for just a buck with the buy one, get one deal. Only in the McDonald's app. Limited time only at participating McDonald's. Valid once per day. Must opt into rewards.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.